as a lack of style, thus betraying a preoccupation with form over substance. But it seems clear that, like the professional newspaperman he was, Simak tried to avoid allowing stylistic flourishes to get in the way of his exposition of the facts of the story. Prose, he believed, is not supposed to distract from the plot. Well, that was the theory. But once in a while, perhaps unable to stop himself, he would drop in a gem of a line. Robert Silverberg saw this and described Simak's work as having a clear, precise, straightforward narrative style. Even before I met him, Clifford D. Simak had become a legendary figure in science fiction, and readers who never had a chance to know him in person are now discovering his work. And I find that in doing so, they become very interested in him, not only in his writing, but also in details of his life that might help color in the picture of this beloved grand master. So let me tell you a little bit about how Cliff did his work of writing fiction. Clifford D. Simak never used a pseudonym, and he engaged in collaborations on only three occasions. In the first of those, he worked with a fellow Twin Cities writer, Carl Jacoby, to produce a story that was first published as The Street That Wasn't There, later reprinted at times as The Lost Street. The collaboration does not seem to have been a pleasant experience. Cliff would later say that he and Carl fought like hell for the weeks it took to write it. The two of them tried it a second time, producing a story called The Cat That Had Nine Lives. That story also sold, but it was never published because the magazine that bought it, Comet, folded. The third of Cliff's collaborations was with his son, Richard, and together they produced a story called Unsilent Spring, which turned out well. Dick, known in the family as Scott, was a government chemist, and Cliff would later insist that his contribution to the story was more than just the science and was essential. My belief is that Cliff Simak's aversion to collaboration was closely related to the fact that he simply did not like to talk about a work in progress. To me, he said, writing is intensely private. If I talk to anyone, I feel the story is not entirely mine anymore. I lose the magic. In the novel All Flesh is Grass, one of Cliff's characters, Nancy, who was a writer herself, would say of that profession, "It's a thing you don't talk about, not until you're well along with it. There are so many things that can go wrong with writing. I don't want to be one of those pseudo-literary people who are always writing something they never finish, or talking about writing something that they never start." "You have to have a hunger," Nancy would add, "a different kind of hunger, to finish up a book." Cliff's way was to spend time thinking about his next story, plotting it out in his head. But once he had it mostly plotted out, when he began to actually put words on paper, it was not unusual for the story to take off on him. And he loved it when that happened, when he found himself putting words on the paper without knowing where they were leading him. He found the process incredible. To him, that was the best kind of writing, because it meant he was writing from, well, he called it his gut, or he called it his nerve endings. But I'd say it was from the world underneath the top of his mind. The process again reflected the author's newspaper training. He began by making notes, often starting by asking himself a question, then answering it, and then beginning to build the stories from pieces he created, trying out alternative beginnings and endings. Sometimes he became so caught up in his creating that he made lists of the names of characters who might be somehow involved. Characters who sometimes never even made it into the story. For the most part, once Cliff had a story worked out in his head, he would begin by using a pencil to compose onto paper. He went to his typewriter only when he thought he had the story worked out to an end in his scrawling longhand, and he used the process of typing it to polish it. After that, he would, when he could afford it, have someone else retype the finished product for submission. Early in his career, which began around the time his marriage was new, his wife Kay would do that retyping. But once he became able to afford to hire a professional typist, Kay,